Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. Implicit in every correct understanding of the master-disciple relationship is the context of the precepts. And the context of the precepts is easily misunderstood. The article by Durkheim wonderfully complements our master's commentary on the precepts in a certain section. So I'm going to take some of our master's commentary on the precepts and Durkheim's article that we've been talking about, one little section of it, and talk about the precepts. One of the things that really impresses me in both contexts is that you really can never separate the master-disciple relationship from the precepts, and you can't separate the master-disciple relationship from any aspect of what we're doing. Again, this is something that people are trying to do because they want to avoid the risk that's inherent in trusting as much as you have to trust another human being. And you simply can't do it. It won't work. If you want to go the highest way, you've got to go the highest way, and you've got to go that way in the way that actually works, not in some delusional way, which definitely won't work. It's really important to remember that the whole purpose of the human master is to point the disciple toward the Buddha nature, their own Buddha nature, to help them come to rely upon their own Buddha nature. A human master who is taken by a disciple, no true master would wish this, but it can happen if a disciple takes a human master to literally take the place of the eternal, take the place of their own Buddha nature. The disciple will never really understand the precepts because the disciple will actually never graduate, as it were, to the real basis for discipleship. In other words, the disciple will never go beyond that first phase, early phase of discipleship, and graduate to what true discipleship really is, what full discipleship is. And you couldn't see a better description of this, explanation of this, in this little Durkheim article. So I'll just read a bit. When the student is born, when the disciple is born, you're not referring to physical birth, when discipleship is awakened within you, when you're ready for discipleship, the inner master is born too. Of course, the inner master is your Buddha nature, and of course that is never, in actual fact, created or destroyed. And your intuitive awareness of your Buddha nature, which always exists in at least a vestigial form, in the little light of faith, which is inextinguishable. But that inner knowledge of Buddha nature is stimulated as when discipleship is awakened within one. Because there are two aspects of the same thing. Our awareness that there's a path that we can walk towards to the cessation of suffering, and that we need someone to guide us on the path, and our awareness of our own Buddha nature, they're all burgeoning together. Although he cannot know the meaning of the term master, the new disciple still intuits it. That's what I'm saying. Intuitively recognize it. Cannot begin to know, not for a long time, the full implications of the term master. And that's really true. For the master within has woken in the form of a new conscience. The master within, the inner master, the Buddha nature, is stimulating the person who is becoming ready for full discipleship to a new sense of a new conscience, a new sense of what is good to do and what is not good to do. Everything's getting rearranged. This conscience is mandatory primal knowledge. Primal knowledge here means what Rinpoche Master calls blood and bones knowledge. Blood and bones understanding of the innate way in which our true nature leads us to total change and perfects us as mediums for being, capital B, as vessels of the eternal, mediums for being. You know, the word medium here is not, hopefully people wouldn't understand it in a goofy way, but it means a vessel, discipleship is realization that one is the vessel of something greater than oneself, and one has a responsibility to that. One is trying to come into alignment with it. So this conscience means, inner knowing. This conscience is mandatory primal knowledge. Mandatory meaning there's no wishy-washiness in it. And there's no evading it. It's a sense of a deep need to follow one's heart. And no matter what the price, no matter what the obstacles, no matter what the difficulties, that's a mandatory nature of it. This has to be done. That's what makes people willing to give up everything, to leave their families, to leave their jobs, to leave everything, to renounce the world and to follow a true master. That's what makes it possible. That something within them is saying, you got to do it. I don't care if you live or die, you're going to do it. And it's something we choose. At least for me, there's always been a sense that sense of urgency and the mandatoriness of the imperative nature of the call to follow the eternal, it's always been a sense of that was the real me in there getting a word in. I never thought it was something outside myself or other than myself, and yet it was definitely not the selfish self. He says it leads us to total change. Remember the way he's using the term change. The total change means continual spiritual transformation, the going on beyond, always going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. Remember the story of when Rinpoche Master took the translation that Shin Yogo had worked out of the Scripture of Great Wisdom to Ko Zenji to check. And he had everything retranslated back into Japanese to check it, check the meaning, or to whatever they were retranslating it back into. And when he got to the end of the Scripture of Great Wisdom, they had translated it as usually done, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone to the other shore. And Ko Zenji said, no, emphatically, no. It's going. Not gone, it's going. That's the meaning of the, that's the way that Durkheim's using this change. He keeps talking about that it means constant change. Another way to put it is there's no resting place in this. No place where you can be complacent. There's no end to the process of conversion. There's no limit to how far you can go. No, we're chasing the infinite. There's no finite attainment that can be the goal. He says, this newly awakened conscience has nothing in common with primitive conscience, which is simply a fear of punishment and operates only when punishment seems imminent. So scratch the fear of punishment, and scratch guilt for that matter, which is just punishing oneself. It ain't guilt and it's not fear of punishment. Similarly, now you use the term absolute conscience, which means real conscience, what conscience really is, has nothing in common with the voice of worldly obligation, the voice with which people, projects, or communities speak when we disobey their rules and which embodies a principle, what the whole is determines how the parts behave. This is why that true perceptual morality is such an essentially alone thing. You don't get it from outside you. It awakens within you. It awakens within you. And the whole meaning of the precepts is really simple. Follow your heart, no matter what the circumstances. Be true to what you really are, no matter what the circumstances. That's what the precepts boil down to. It's a really dangerous business to try to make an accommodation between that way of living and worldly morality. And there are always places where there are, at least in appearance, similarities, strong resemblances. But that breaks down at a certain point. It breaks down wherever world immorality veers off into worldly values and worldly beliefs. If you look at our own society, you know, there's a very strong belief in the value of punishment and the need to arrive at some kind of conclusion when there has been a crime or a real serious violation of the moral principles by in some way punishing the offender or calling the offender on the carpet. Nowadays, see, people have basically taken psychology to be a kind of substitute religion. You see all over the news, you know, the people talking about they can only have closure when the person who did this awful thing is executed or sent to jail or something. And that's just a pure delusion. There's no peace in that. There's no peace and no resolution in that. There may be a temporary relief of a sort, but the fundamental grief and anguish will not be diminished by that. The answer is stop being God and let go. Stop playing God and let go. Return that which you love, which has been taken from you. Return that which you love to the source of all love in your heart and in your mind. Stop playing God. We don't possess those who we love. We don't possess that which we love. We don't possess anything. Vengeance is the action of someone who thinks he possesses something. It's getting it's an eye for an eye, basically. Getting my own back out of someone by causing them pain. That's just primitive, really. It has no place in Buddhism. And this is morality in our society. So the person who refuses to play that game doesn't fit. And there's many other ways in which someone who follows the precepts will not fit the true spirit of the precepts. He goes on to say, the inner master's voice, the inner master's voice, the voice of the eternal, the voice of the Lord of the house, he talks about it. Our master talks about it. The inner master's voice demands only that we be totally faithful to the inner core experience in our own soul. And here's a Buddhist. He knows the teaching of no self, and he's talking about a soul. But you can't get bogged down in philosophy. It's just another name for Buddha nature here. Your own Buddha nature. I'll read that again. The inner master's voice demands only that we be totally faithful to the inner core experience in our own soul. The omnipresence of the absolute expresses itself as absolute conscience in the person who has woken to discipleship. The inner master's voice is uncompromising, and no one can call himself a disciple truly unless he is willing to obey it. This obedience also implies unconditional discipline. And this discipline here doesn't mean, he's going to explain it, I'll read that. Discipline here doesn't mean what we normally think of as discipline. Certainly it doesn't mean discipline as often used in a popular sense of punishment of any kind. It doesn't mean religious exercises. You know, you do enough religious exercises and you purge yourself of evil kind of thing. It doesn't mean that. He says, there are two types of discipline, imposed and accepted. Imposed discipline means subjection to an outside authority which is experienced as an alien force and a limitation on freedom. Accepted discipline expresses fidelity to a personal decision concerning our true nature, the source of all true freedom. To truly live the precepts frees you because it enables you to follow your true nature without hindrance. And that's very different from taking on a moral code in the normal sense, subjecting oneself to some kind of external authority. This is a really scary thing about Buddhism to a lot of people, that you can live from your own true nature without reference to the shared values of a group. Reverend Master tells a story of some when she was just a young monk. She went out on the probably on the day off and the rest day and to do some business in town. And some of the other young monks saw her cross the street on her own. And the way she crossed the street, they said to her, you cross the street like Zen master. You know, what did they mean? Well, the way she explained it is that people tend to do things in groups a lot in the Far East. For anyone to kind of stride out on their own was indicative of a great confidence, a great self-confidence. Now, granted that our Western values tend to really emphasize the individual a lot more, so maybe we can stride out on our own too much. And of course, you know, that's another danger. Stride out on your own in the sense of ignoring your Buddha nature. And that is not what is meant here. You could say that in Western philosophy, the philosopher of that kind of extremity of selfish individualism is Nietzsche. You know, who is mad as a March hare. He's nuts, really. A brilliant, nutty person. What's being talked about here is being true to your own Buddha nature. In her commentary on the precepts, Burma Master says, know that the Lord will never break the precepts. That doesn't mean that you will always do, if you're following the eternal truly, it does not mean you will always do what the world sees as being good to do or right to do. Nor does it mean, however, that you are simply being a law to your own self without regard for anyone else. The true middle path, remember, Master, I heard her say this at least once, the true meaning of the middle path is a transcendent path. It transcends the opposites. So I've been talking here about two opposites, one of selfish individualism, the other one is in just going along with the crowd, to put them kind of both kind of in a very plain speaking way. And neither one of these will get us anywhere spiritually. Some people would say, in talking like I am, that I'm ignoring the Sangha refuge. But one of the precepts is taking refuge in the Sangha, so I'm not ignoring the Sangha refuge at all. When it is good, when the Eternal leads us to take refuge in the Sangha, then it is good to take refuge in the Sangha. And each of us is a Sangha member. When we listen to our own heart, we're also taking refuge in the Sangha. Listen to what Rim Master says in her commentary on the precepts. Do not do anything unless it is good. She puts a little parenthesis around good. Unless it is good. Do not do anything unless I have first asked the Lord of the house if it is good for me to do it. Do nothing whatsoever in a hurry. Do nothing whatsoever on the spur of the moment unless I know the certainty given by the Lord of the house. Know that I must take the consequences of what I do if it is not a fully digested act, for I know what lies beyond good and evil, right and wrong. I know that which lies beyond morality, worldly morality she's speaking of here, ordinary morality. I know the Lord of the house. Ask the Lord of the house at all times before I do anything whatsoever. Is it good? Is it your will? If I do not ask the Lord of the house builder of the house of ego will again pick up his tools, and before I know it, there will be a great structure from which I must again escape. If a thing is good in this way, it may be done. If it is not good in this way, it should not be done. I am not speaking here of good and evil. I am speaking of good in the sense of if it is right. This is beyond right and wrong. If it is good, it is beyond good and evil. This teaching is indeed the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, for there was not one of his acts that was not the result of fully digested preceptual truth. If I live thus, doing only that which is good, after I have asked the Lord of the house, after I know the true Lord of the house, then I can know the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment and know that his enlightenment and mine are identically the same. But this is only if I know who the Lord of the house is and do not suffer from the idea that I am the Lord of the house. Always I must ask the Lord of the house. Always I must be humble in his presence. Now listen to this. This is, for me, the very essence of the deep spiritual life in what she says now. Please teach me that which is good for me to do this day. Please show me that which is good for me to teach this day. Please give me the certainty that I teach the truth, and know indeed that when the still small voice within my heart and mind says yes, I must obey that teaching. When it says no, I must not disobey that teaching. When the Lord speaks, spring up joyfully to answer. Then indeed it is good to do anything whatsoever. Know that the Lord will never break the precepts. In these passages that I've read from Durkheim and from Reverend Master, they're saying exactly the same thing. Reverend Master is going much further, however, in giving you the detailed way of doing it. And that's why I love the way that that passage I just read ends. Because that's how I, in the end, really learned to turn towards the Eternal and ask, please help me in this situation. Please help me with this. Please show me what is good to do. Please help me not to do that which is not good to do. And this is, I don't know if anyone really ever really learns this without spending a good deal of time simply on hands and knees spiritually. You've got to do your time down there in the trenches. Really suffering and really knowing that you're up against it and you need the help of something greater than yourself. Otherwise, we always go around with the best of intentions, being God in our own head. And while we are God in our own head, we don't turn and sincerely ask the Eternal with deep humility, I do not know the answer. Please show me the way. No one ever gets sufficiently good at doing this to ever be complacent for a moment. One moment of complacency and the self jumps right back in. And then again, you have to escape from that house of ego, just as she says. It's quite neat the way that works, actually, because it keeps you on your toes. The self, greed, hate, and delusion, the self is really the non-existent focal point of greed, hate, and delusion. But the self and greed, hate, and delusion, they're not the enemy here. Reverend Master used to say, Mara is the least appreciated servant of the Eternal. The self is not the enemy. And if we don't train the self and be vigilant, then it'll just run us all over the map. And we'll create mountains of suffering for ourselves. What's being talked about in both the passages that I've read is what I've been referring to again and again in recent months as the true spirit of the precepts. I've been using that term very deliberately to distinguish from the tendency to take refuge in the letter of the precepts and the letter of the rule in a way to find a kind of false security there and a false refuge in the letter. You cannot afford to get stuck with the letter of anything if you're going to follow your heart. It doesn't mean that you necessarily ignore the letter, by the way, but you can't get stuck with it. You can't fixate on it. Now I'm safe because I'm following the letter. The streams of karma are full of people who followed the letter and at the time of their death awoke to the fact that they had betrayed themselves and that they had betrayed those they loved. You know, we're very familiar in modern times with the excuse, I was just following orders. We're not here to just follow orders. We're here to follow our heart. And we get the consequences of what we do. Whether we get it right or wrong in any sense, we're going to get the consequences of what we do. It's very important for those who would truly understand discipleship and truly walk in the way of a disciple of the eternal to not be a sucker for formulas and for superficial ways of viewing things. The precepts are a deep teaching. The meaning of the master-disciple relationship, the meaning of what discipleship is at its deepest level, which is the pure following of the eternal for the sake of nothing other than the following of the eternal. That and the precepts are one right down to their core. Without true discipleship, there can be no true following of the precepts. Without the true following of the precepts, there can be no true discipleship. It's that simple. That's why you cannot simply take Buddhism and chop out the master-disciple relationship and be left with meditation, the precepts, rules, ways of doing things, practices, bowing, ceremonial, etc., and carry on. Because you've just cut the heart out of it. You just get a delusion of Buddhism. Nor could you have the master-disciple relationship, meditation, ceremonial, etc., etc., rules, practices, and leave out the precepts. And you've done the same thing. These are aspects of the same thing. They're not subject to my personal will. I didn't invent them. Vermaster didn't invent them. Ko Zenji didn't invent them. They go right down to the heart of our existence. They are to be treasured and revered and put into practice. Not queried, subjected to skepticism, watered down, or excised out. This is the Buddha, this is the Dharma.